Imagine a toy so iconic it practically wrote the playbook for pleasure. Allow me to introduce or reintroduce you to the Magic Wand, aka the Cadillac of Vibrators. The Magic Wand Original is a trusted companion in the journey of joy. Whether it's your first time chasing an orgasm or you're looking to give your partner a spine-tingling erotic massage, the Magic Wand should be your go-to. With powerful rumbles and several different rhythms and patterns, it's no wonder the Magic Wand has scooped up accolades like Vibrator of the Year for decades. I'm so enamored with mine, I've customized my bedside table just to keep it within arm's reach at all times. But the magic doesn't stop with the original Magic Wand. The Magic Wand family has grown over the years, offering a variety of models to suit every lifestyle. Go cord-free with the Magic Wand Rechargeable. Embrace compact power without compromising intensity with the Magic Wand Mini. I love this Mini. Or the Micro, which is just teeny tiny and really powerful. Or enjoy a range of sensations with the Magic Wand Plus. Each model delivers the same powerful orgasmic rumble that made the original a legend. So are you ready to experience the magic? Visit sexwithemily.com/magicwand and discover why the Magic Wand continues to enchant pleasure seekers around the globe. That's sexwithemily.com/magicwand. Magic Wand, more than just a vibrator. Did you know that your gut is directly connected to your brain and can contribute to anxiety, stress, and depression, which, by the way, can also impact your sexual health? So here's my secret weapon for gut health, Just Thrive Probiotic. Now listen up. Just Thrive isn't just any ordinary probiotic. It is the only one that survives your stomach acid and reaches your gut 100% alive. All those others, the ones that come in fancy drinks or you gotta refrigerate, nope, that's not even a thing. This is the one. I've noticed significant changes to my overall health. Like, this might be TMI, but I'm way more regular and my skin is glowing. Think of Just Thrive like your personal gut gardener. It maintains the health of your gut by weeding out the bad bacteria that causes all those digestive issues and then replenishes the good, making it a total game changer for your digestion, your immune system, your skin, even your mood and sexual health. And if you want to check out my episode with Just Thrive's founder, Tina Anderson, we talk all about how gut bacteria plays a crucial role in your overall happiness, including your sex life. Because a healthy, balanced gut means less stress and more energy. So if you want to check it out, I'm offering a deal for my listeners. You can save 20% off site-wide at justthrivehealth.com with the promo code SEXWITHEMILY. That's 20% off on the probiotic that's truly changing lives and making waves in the wellness community. Everyone's talking about it. Don't just take my word for it. Try it for yourself. Go to justthrivehealth.com. Use promo code SEXWITHEMILY for 20% off. Thanks for listening to Sex with Emily. I'm Dr. Emily, and on today's show, we're looking back at some of my popular guests, legendary porn star Nina Hartley, sex addiction expert Marnie Breaker, and erotic film director, screenwriter, and producer Erica Lust. All this and more. Thanks for listening.
What is that? That's like a bunch of women with a lot of hair around their arms, and they put on the strap-ons, you know, and they're like this army ready to fuck the men.
Well, that's a whole different issue. The reality is with sex addiction, it's a disease that occurs in secrecy. So when someone's looking at a lot of porn and they're keeping it from their partner, likely there is something to hide.
Butts are like cats. They must be coaxed and seduced every time. Butts know when what is touching them is paying attention or being a jerk.
Look into his eyes. They're the eyes of a man obsessed by sex. Eyes that mock our sacred institutions. Bedroom eyes, they call them in a bygone day.
You're listening to Sex with Emily. I'm Dr. Emily, and I'm here to help you prioritize your pleasure and liberate the conversation around sex. All right, you've probably heard me talking about celebrating 15 years of Sex with Emily. Well, today we're going to continue the celebration with three of my popular guests from over the years. These were so great to listen to, and I love that they're all together here in one episode, because first, I talked to the legend, porn star Nina Hartley, who's super open about her experience in the adult industry. She's thoughtful about her life outside of porn. I mean, so many of you want to know, like, what are porn stars' lives like outside of, you know, having sex for a living? And she's incredible. I love this conversation. Then I talked to Dr. Marnie Breaker, and she's a licensed marriage and family therapist and a sex addiction specialist. So we talk a lot about, you know, what's the difference between enjoying frequent sex and actual sex addiction? Because we can sort of conflate sex addiction with porn. And while porn can be used as part of an addiction, you know, simply watching porn doesn't mean you're addicted. A lot of you call in, you're like, well, I watch porn every day. Am I an addict? Or I think my partner's addicted to porn. And, you know, since porn is so much more readily available right now, there's so many questions and so many theories. So we're going to break it down today. That's why I'm giving you Dr. Breaker and Nina Hartley so we can see the difference in this episode. Then I talked to Erica Lust, and she's been on the show a few times. She's a Swedish erotic film director, screenwriter, producer, and she's essentially on a mission to create ethical porn. What does that mean? Well, you have to listen. We get into her philosophy and how it actually shapes the films that she creates. So if you've been looking for porn that actually speaks to you and is hot for you, especially as a vulva owner, you're going to like what Erica has to say. I love visiting these conversations, so you're going to love all this. I have an amazing woman sitting here in the studio with me, Nina Hartley. Hello.
Hello.
Yay, I love the clapping. Nina is, if you don't know, because everyone knows who Nina is, American pornographic actress, director, sex educator, feminist, author. You've been in how many films?
About 900.
900 films. Ish-ish. And you're still doing films.
Oh, absolutely.
And everything. You're activist. You've done so many things. And I'm so in awe of your career and all the amazing things you've done. And we're going to talk about sex tonight. I mean, sex with Emily.
Really?
But I if
love
anyone,
that.
I
my
almost
favorite
feel like
topic.
I should. I know. How about that?
Isn't it awesome?
I know. And we're going to get into the stuff, all the things that you've ever wanted. Ask Nina. And I feel like so many of my listeners, they need tips. They need advice for keeping their relationships interesting and how to have a spicy sex life. And I love oral sex tips. I always ask my guests. And I feel like you would have really good oral sex tips for women and for men. Tell me what you're up to now. What are you working on? Nina.com, which is amazing. You have that URL.
Right. Yeah. Nina.com is my
website.
Pay site. And it's triple X. I've been doing this 32 years since I started dancing and 30 years in porn. And I am now old enough to have children in their 30s. I have been working, putting more energy into branching out just in terms of talking and teaching because I've been a feminist my whole life. And so I remember the early days of the conversation about pornography and sex and sexuality and sexual expression from the 70s. And now I have 40 years perspective on how's that working for you.
Right, exactly.
So I'm the age of a lot of young people's parents, but I'm not a parent, so I'm not icky.
Right.
So I wanted to give back to the community. I want to talk to young adults about what I wish I'd known about sex when I was their age.
So when you say young, you're talking about people in their 20s?
I'm talking for me, 18 to 30. I'm 54. I could easily have a 30-year-old child.
Yeah,
without it being weird.
Right.
Two of my favorite playmates were born the year I graduated high school, and they're 35. It blows my mind. But I see them as peers because they're
adults. What do you mean your playmates? People that you play with, have sex with?
I am not a monogamous person, and I'm also queer, so I have a large circle of poly, bi, queer, non-monogamous, polymorphously perverse.
Exactly.
So I live a very sexually open lifestyle, and what people get confused about who are not wired this way is they could choose open with anarchic, with like no rules at all. And what it really is, it's a kind of sexual orientation that works best when you keep it within people of your like orientation.
Right.
So people with whom I play, and for me, play is almost always some kind of sexual intention, mm-hmm. if not actual genital contact, are people who share my sexual values, my sexual outlook, most of my overlaps sexual philosophy enough that we can cohabit the same space and share some kind of mutual good time. And I don't try to do that with people whose sexual values and boundaries don't mesh with mine. And the biggest thing I could tell anybody as a young adult is figure out what, and this is something you can do alone while reading. You don't even have to do it with anybody. It's just something inside yourself. What do I seem to be? I'm strongly pulled toward monogamy. I'm strongly pulled toward non-monogamy, but I feel guilty about it because of what I've been told. So am I really monogamous and wanting a fantastical dream? Or am I actually a non-monogamous person burdened with guilt? So we have to investigate.
Exactly.
So, and on and on. So my playmates, and they're 35, and they're born the year I graduated high school. It's like, get the F out of Dodge.
Right,
oh,
exactly.
My God.
But
I feel, as I feel more alive than ever. I wouldn't go back and be 35 again if you paid me, because at 35, I was entering the most unhappy period of my first marriage.
Okay.
Where I was craziest and most absolutely. So I've been unhappily married. I'm happily married now. And I have insights I can impart to people. And also the whole thing about personal responsibility. Stop
right.
feeling like such a victim. I'm sure you talk about that with
yes.
people all the time.
Yes. Feeling like a victim in their own life. You mean in their own.
Especially when it comes
life.
To sex. Poor
right.
me, poor me. And, you know, pull up your big person panties.
Right, exactly.
And we're not talking about actually having been victimized, obviously. We're not talking about violence.
No,
but we're
right,
talking about where you do
exactly.
when you're crazy. You keep
exactly.
picking the wrong partners.
Oh,
you
my
have
God.
This pattern that you act out again and again. You realize, and after the third time, it is you.
Exactly. It's like, what's the common denominator here? Oh, okay, it's me. I know. I fully blame myself for all of my mistakes now. Like, I think it's so funny about my relationships. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is my pattern. And people don't stop, but they don't stop and look at themselves. But I think it's interesting. So have you always known that you were non-monogamous or when you were
yes.
married? Okay.
If I'd had the words in high school, I would have recognized that I was as to quote Reed Mahalko, a poly-bi slut.
But I love Reed. Reed Sandwich, right. We love you, Reed. Yes.
We love you, Reed. Read about sex. And I never had a monogamous fantasy in my life. I always fantasized about them. I never fantasized about him. And I always felt strange about that. So when it comes to sex, I feel like Spock. If you have friends who are very, very strongly gay, they'll tell you, oh, I knew from first grade. Oh, I
right.
knew since I was 5 years old. Oh, absolutely. And you know people like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So my sexuality is as strong and inborn in me as their gayness. But because I didn't have language for it, I didn't know that it had to do with relational orientation.
Right.
Because poly is and monogamous is separate from gay or kinky or bisexual. It's
right.
just how do you want to run your romantic life? And I need a wide variety of people with whom I can be sexual. And I have a husband and people will say, Nina, why be married if you're not going to be monogamous?
Right.
And I say, well, my husband's my through partner. So all the sex I have is intentional.
Right.
We negotiate it. We are doing it deliberately. It's not because someone got drunk. So each time I'm with someone, that's a beautiful bead. Maybe this is a carved ivory bead, or this is a Murano glass bead, or this is a Hopi Indian bead. And I string all those beads on the through relationship I have with my husband. And they, for me, that balances out.
Right. And does he see other people as well? Or?
Nothing seriously. I'm polyamorous. He's non-monogamous.
Okay.
but the orientations work well enough that we can make it work. My primary, when I got out of my first marriage, I knew that I would be single until I was dead and have cats and lovers before I would ever consent again to be with a possessive partner.
And there's enough for everyone,
and
right?
And as a poly person, A is A. Nothing else can be A, and nothing else can be, they don't compete.
Exactly.
So if there's another slender, attractive, accomplished, intelligent, young brunette woman over here who can rock the plaid pants, which I no longer bother trying to wear, and if there's someone who on the surface of it looked a lot like you, I would not be confused because you're you and she would be
right.
her. So you vibrate this string. In that harmonic resonance way. And she can't pluck your string.
Right, exactly.
Only
people
you
get
or
jealous
you.
And they're possessive. And so I totally understand. Do you think that there's a lot of people that would be non-monogamous or polyamorous if they could, but they don't even think that's an option because they have to be monogamous? I think a lot of people are suffering through monogamy.
I think monogamy is an honest orientation. I think a solid 20% of people are truly monogamous.
Right.
One partner is all they want and they're devoted their whole lives. And it's not a burden in... They are it. This is
yeah.
it. I met your mother when we were 15. I fell in love and never looked at another woman since. I've met enough couples like that to know that for some people is true. And then there is 20% of the people like me who are fully acclimated to a functioning, healthy, non-monogamous relational style and have a good partner and are okay with that. And the other 60% are struggling with some balance of it. I think more people could be more open and fluid than are now.
Yeah.
If it were considered a healthy option. Right now, you know, monogamy is the only thing that's healthy and normal and mature and respectful. I would never put up with my partner. You let him do what?
Right.
You let her do what? It's like not letting.
Right.
So clearly, I can't be with someone like you. And I tried that. I tried very hard. I fail at monogamy. I completely
incapable. I did too.
I ended up being a cheater.
Right.
I ended up being a liar. It was crazy. But this is why I want to strangle them.
Okay.
People and say, well, you know, I want other partners, but I don't want my partner to have anybody else. It's like, then you are too immature for this. You don't get to have the cookie.
Right.
Because this is a two-way street.
Exactly.
Now, because in our culture, people get stunted emotionally at very young ages around sexuality and pleasure and what do I get to have in the world? And then they grow up to be big people and they interact with another adult person and then a trigger gets pushed. All of a sudden, they're, again, a very young child and they don't want to have to deal with their stuff. You have to do it first because I'm not going to. It's like, right. I thought I was dating a grown-up.
Exactly. No, I understand. And monogamy has never worked for me, really. And I love hearing you say this because I still think I try to get into relationships, but I used to be a cheater. I'm a reformed cheater because I don't really commit now. And if I do, I'm like, okay, this is more open. But it's something that I never wanted from a young age. I'm never wanting it.
And never fantasized about it.
But I kept thinking that...
What's wrong with you for not wanting it?
I'm like, well, one day I'll want to get married. Well, one day I'll want to have kids. You know, it'll all happen. And I think it's so good. But no, at this point, it's just not going to happen.
I mean, I kept waiting.
I have relationships and it doesn't.
Right. I kept waiting for to want kids and it never. The joke now is at the factory, they forgot to wind my biological clock.
Exactly. That's what I always say. I don't have one. I love kids. I love them.
Love them.
But let's go back to your child. So you grew up in Berkeley, California. Mm-hmm. Growing up in Berkeley then, what were your parents like? Were they?
Oh, my parents are totally alt. My father was a blacklisted radio personality. So I grew up after he'd been blacklisted.
He was
the last people McCarthy got. And my mother, they had a pretty modern marriage and my mother was going back to school to get her master's and she had a job too. And so I grew up in a very avant-garde female breadwinner, male homekeeper household 20 years before that was popular. So that was very difficult for everybody
I'm
involved.
I'm sure it must have been.
So I was the youngest and so I had a lot of time to myself to pursue my own interests. My parents were all of the 60s deeply into therapy. Can tell you
everything.
You got it. And in 1969, they found Zen Buddhism and started studying that seriously. In 1973, my mother quit her job, became full-time students. And my mother is a senior priest at the Zen Center in San Francisco.
Oh, she is? She still is?
I'm so grateful because being 1969, it could have been Est. It could have been Hare Krishna.
I was going to ask you if it was Est.
It could have been Scientology.
Thank God,
it was Zen.
No, that's what I was going to say to you. Thank God.
So, yes, I was a lonely child. Yes, my parents feel very bad about that.
Right.
But the positive thing out of all of that is that they show by their example that their life had been upended by my father's blacklistedness. And so they showed me that a person can cast about and find the best way to make an honorable and meaningful life for yourself according to your own needs. And for a proto-queer kid who didn't know that word yet, it was very, very liberating because part of what they also looked at was sexuality. And then there was a feminist movement where I got some of the source material because of these brand new ideas. And so there was, before the anti-pornography feminist took over the whole wing of feminism, there was actually quite open discussion about sex workers' rights and women's bodies beautiful. It was just really great. So it was very empowering, the thinking about.
Right, exactly.
But I was younger enough that I hadn't become an adult in that environment. So I was reading people's projections on a utopian way of being around sexuality young enough that I grew into it. I was quite codependent for a number of years.
Okay.
And so in my secret mind, I wanted to be braver like Betty Dodson. And in my real life, I just couldn't quite break that pattern until I finally did at 40. It's like, oh, I'm holding myself back.
Right. It's always us holding ourselves back. We're the only ones holding ourselves back. I know. Absolutely. That's true. So you went to school. You graduated from Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And then you became a nurse or you went to nursing school?
I graduated from Berkeley High School.
Which all my friends who went to Berkeley High School are the most interesting people. The way they eat, the way they talk, the religion.
I know. They're pretty cool people.
Yeah.
I was in the theater department, which was fabulous for me. And I discovered pornography when I was 14 and was reading the books by the bedside of this cool 70s swinging couple that I babysat for regularly. And they had a waterbed. And it was 1972, 1973, and 1974. So the height of it. So I found the joy of sex and the happy hooker. Maybe want to be a prostitute that very day. And I still, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, wouldn't that be great?
Could have been a prostitute. I think that too sometimes.
If it were legal business, you know, and you're educated. So I know some of the anti-pornography screed is, what they don't like about porn is that it portrays women as whores by nature. Setting aside for the moment that the reason you watch porn is to watch people in sexual action as opposed to any other kind of movie.
Right.
I agree with them that not all women are whores by nature, but she says, raising her hand, some are.
Right, exactly.
You know, some of us are suited for this job. So some of us are suited to be law enforcement. Some of us are suited to be lawyers. Some of us are suited to be accountants. And I'm suited to be a sexual intermediary.
How do you think that porn today is impacting like young people who are learning about sex? And
well, I think that's the only place they're seeing sex. It's certainly impacting them in a way that is going to make good sex that's much harder to get to. If we could counter porn with actual age-appropriate comprehensive sex education that is safety and pleasure-based. So before you're watching porn, you should be watch all the porn you want.
Right.
Consume all the media you want to consume. This is where women accuse me of being a secret conservative because I believe in personal responsibility. So I've had the life that I've had. I've had the experiences that I've had. I've consumed the media that I've had. I've had the media messages into me that I've had. Eventually, when we're alone together in a room, it's just you and me. And what how am I going to be? Am I going to be a dipshit, ignorant, lame-ass cunt?
Right.
Or am I going to be a human who says, wow, you know what? I'm really uncomfortable now because this is new for me. Or wow, you're really beautiful. Or golly, I'm really scared. Or you know what? I really liked this idea back at the bar, but now that we're here, I really want to keep my clothes on. Or you know what? Can we have some
whatever it is. Because women think they get in a situation or I owe it to them or he bought me dinner or I'm too drunk and people just make all these mistakes.
Don't even get that. You as a person think that a human partner is going to like what a movie is doing, then you are not ready to have a partner in your bed with you. You need to back up and get acquainted with your own body and not just on talking guys. Here's what I tell women. Don't bother getting another person in bed with you until you on your own can reliably give yourself an orgasm, preferably a couple of ways. But if only one way, reliably know that I can do this.
How do you, anal sex, huge right now. I mean, I feel like in the last 10 years, I don't even feel like people talked about like when I was in high school ever, it didn't come
totally
up, didn't
not.
Know it. No guy ever ventured there. But now, and I do believe it's because of porn that they think, oh, that's what it's expected of me, men and women, right?
Well, yeah, certainly. And again, there is what we feel porn is quote unquote telling us. And then what I'm telling you is we don't learn to drive a car by watching Vin Diesel. We don't learn about spycraft by watching 007. And we don't learn about actual sex with a human person by watching porn. We may get a couple of cool ideas with a wrist flip or something.
Right.
But in the end, ladies and gents, good sex is sex that pleases both people and makes them go, you know what? That was really great. I'd like to see you again. I feel good after it, not bad, not guilty, not shamefaced, not apologetic, not sorry for it.
Let's first talk about men and women. They've never had anal sex. How would you?
First, the only people who should attempt anal pleasure are those who are sincerely interested in it for their own sake. So butts are like cats. They must be coaxed and seduced every time. And they cannot lie. You cannot make your butt relax. You cannot make it want it what it doesn't want. Butts know when what is touching them is paying attention or being a jerk, including ourselves. So if one wants to investigate anal sex, first, one needs to invest in a high water, high natural fiber diet to make things all regular.
Right.
Okay. If you have bowel issues or poop issues,
that's not going to be the thing for you yet.
No, yet. Thank you for saying yet. So
first,
I have to be interested in it for myself. Can't do it to please anybody. It has to be because it's pleasing to you. It's like, oh, hey, wait a minute. Cool.
Right.
So there's that. Then you read about it. So you have some actual information. If you're a female, Tristan Taramino's book is excellent. And if you're a male, Jack Moran's book, Anal Pleasure and Health, is excellent. And just get acquainted with it and understand. So much of the resistance to anal pleasure is cultural. To get to the point where you can touch the outside of your anus in a pleasurable way while touching the front of you and putting those two sensations together, that's 80% of the battle.
Don't go anywhere. There's more Sex with Emily coming right up after this break. There's nothing quite like sinking your teeth into a good sandwich. But listen, carb guilt is real. I'm someone who's very invested in my health, and I like to get my carbs from oats and beans and fruits and not bread. But I love bread. So here's my hack.
Thanks to Hero Bread, you can enjoy your favorite bready delights without the carb consequences. Hero Bread has turned those carby, empty calorie bread products into fluffy, delicious breads that boast 0 to 1 net carbs per serving, 0 grams of sugar, and are packed with loads of fiber and protein. The first time I tried their white bread, I was skeptical. Could it really taste good with such impressive nutritional stats? Well, I'm pleasantly surprised to say it absolutely does. The texture is just phenomenal. It's like this soft, airy, and it just toasts up like a dream. I've whipped up everything from grilled cheese to PB&J and even made enchiladas, wraps, and tacos with their tortillas. Each time, Hero Bread has been a game changer. And here's the kicker. Despite its light texture and great taste, Hero Bread fits perfectly into my health goals. It's been adding more fiber to my diet while keeping the sugar at bay. Whether I'm packing a picnic lunch, planning a road trip snack, which I often do, or prepping French toast for breakfast, Hero Bread is my go-to. So whether you're craving a classic sandwich, a burger, or a hearty bun, or even indulging in a low net carb croissant, Hero Bread is something for everyone. And I highly recommend checking their monthly small batch drops out so you can try goodies like the 1 gram net carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit and so much more. You won't believe what they have. So you ready to kick carb guilt to the curb? Head over to hero.co and snag 10% off your order with the code Emily. That's Emily at hero.co.
I have Marnie Breaker here. Marnie founded the Center for Relational Healing. The website is lacrh.com. We're going to be giving that out again. And Marnie is a licensed marriage and family therapist, a certified sex addiction therapist, the founder of the Center for Relational Healing in West Los Angeles. And she also specializes in healing relationships that are impacted by the trauma of sex addiction, infidelity, and betrayal. And I am so excited that you're here. Marnie and I met at a dinner. Like, we were just randomly at a dinner.
Best dinner ever.
Like, literally had a blast. And then I find out, like, what she does. And we're talking about what I did for a living. And I'm like, you have to be on the show because, first of all, she's genius. I mean, she started her own business and she's just so much fun and a blast. Like, I know we're friends. It's going to be, like, lifelong friends. But also, I started thinking about the show. I really don't think in the 12 years I've been doing this that I've had a sex addiction specialist therapist on the show. If I did, it was a long time ago. And I feel like with everything going on right now, all these things happening with all these allegations against a lot of powerful men in Hollywood who have been accused of sex addiction, but also the way porn's changed, how it's like infiltrated our lives. It's how a lot of kids are learning about sex for the first time. So there's just a lot to unpack with you, Marnie. Marnie, you are the perfect person to be here and do it with me. So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi. Okay, so Marnie, tell me, how did you get into sex addiction therapy, training, all that?
I fell into sex addiction training. I was in graduate school and I needed to get a traineeship in order to graduate. Essentially needed like 600 hours. And so the only place that was really available to me at the time was Del Amo Hospital in Torrance, which was an inpatient psychiatric hospital. And so I worked there. And at the very end, they put me on the sexual recovery program and the National Trauma Center. And I never would have wanted to work in sex addiction. It's not something I ever would have thought that I would do.
You didn't have like a history or, okay.
No history, nothing personal in my life, thankfully. And when I was working on that unit, I realized there was a huge correlation between trauma and sex addiction. And so I was able to really develop the empathy, I think, that you need in order to be able to work with that kind of population.
I thought it was 1 in 3 have experienced sexual trauma. But it's any trauma.
Okay. But also we're talking about men experiencing trauma.
Men too, 1 in 5 or something?
Yes.
So can you define sex addiction?
So the best way to make somebody who's not familiar with sex addiction understand it would be it's just like alcohol addiction or food addiction or drug addiction. So it's basically engaging in some kind of sexual behavior when you are acting in congruence with your own values and beliefs, when you're continuing the behavior despite negative consequences in your life, when you are making repeated efforts to stop, you know, you get caught and you say, I'm never doing this again, and you find yourself doing the same thing the next day. And also needing more. So tolerance and withdrawal are like the two foundations of dependency on any drug or substance or behavior. And so sex addict needs more and more and more to get the same.
When people who say sex addiction doesn't really exist because there's no withdrawal symptoms, isn't that what people?
People do say that. And it's not the same as maybe what a drug addict would experience with like the shaking and really needing to go to detox. But sex addicts actually do withdraw. And you might see a lot more like psychosomatic symptoms and a lot of anxiety, but you do see shaking.
Right. And they
depression.
Might replace it, right, with something else.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
Isn't that kind of like part of it? I mean, it's really just trying to soothe ourselves, right? Kind of mask a lot of, you know, emotions because we don't really know how to deal with a lot of emotions. Would you say that a lot of it comes back to that whatever it is, however it manifests in the world, it's sort of a symptom of other things?
Yeah, it's a maladaptive way of coping.
Right.
Self-soothing, trying to regulate oneself, trying to ground themselves.
Are there warning signs for sex addiction?
Well, there are two very different things. So if we're talking about sex addiction, you know, I actually wrote an article. I should send it to you, Emily. I got to find it. But yeah. I wrote an article for single women about how to know what to look for. And when somebody becomes sexual or sexualizes a conversation really fast, that's actually a big red flag right off the bat. You know,
really?
Yeah, yeah. Like, yeah, sexualizing something very quick is just,
give
not
an example.
Say,
not like just like, hey, are we going to bone after dinner? But more like...
I'll give you a perfect
that
example.
That steak looks like what I wanted. I don't know.
Well, yeah, that actually, I know what you were getting at. But yes, that could be an example, but it doesn't have to be, it could be subtle. Years ago when I was dating, I was on that J-Date site, you know, many years ago. And this guy and I were talking, we were chatting. It was kind of late. It was maybe like 11, 1130 at night. And he, I sent something to him and he's like, can you call me? Like he wanted to get on the phone right away. I know that doesn't sound like a big deal, but when I spoke to him on the phone, I actually agreed to get on the phone with him.
Okay.
Probably shouldn't admit that, but I did. I got on the phone with him and he disclosed to me in that conversation that he's a sex addict. So, and I had a weird feeling as soon as he wanted to get on the phone so quick, there's like an urgency. There's an urgency. There's, you know, there's not a lot of boundaries. You can see that with sex addicts. Like they push your boundaries. They're not really respectful when you're saying no or you're setting limits.
Okay.
When somebody is constantly lying or keeping secrets, you know, even hearing about someone with a pretty significant trauma background, not that all of them will become sex addicts or drug addicts, but, you know, it is something to be aware of and to see how did the trauma impact this person now as an adult.
Can you describe some of the common sexual addiction behaviors, what that looks like when they're coming to treatment, they've been addicted to prostitutes or porn or?
Yeah. So I'd say the most common would be porn, compulsive masturbation, prostitutes, escorts, massage parlors, strip clubs. Those would be the
Those
biggest.
Are the top ones. So it's really not even with the partners necessarily.
With their own partners?
Yeah.
No.
Sex addiction. It's really not. Like their partners are separate from it. We get so many questions. We're like, my partner watches porn. Is it a problem? How do we know if it's a problem? So I feel like a lot of times it's just also that women just have a hard time that my partner's looking at anything else that's getting them turned on and it's not me.
Well, that's a whole different issue. The reality is with sex addiction, it's a disease that occurs in secrecy. So when someone's looking at a lot of porn and they're keeping it from their partner, likely there is something to hide. We're not going to get into a whole conversation about whether or not pornography is
good or bad.
Exactly. But when you're in a relationship with somebody, keeping a secret like that you have, that you look at a lot of pornography and that you're masturbating to it, even to the point where you can't really perform in your own relationship, that's a problem. And so, I mean, to get back to the person's question about signs, you know, I would say that when you're in a relationship or you're getting to know somebody who is incredibly secretive and they are not disclosing, and they're not vulnerable, like those are some big signs, you know?
Not vulnerable about anything.
Right. Can't connect. Sex addiction is an intimacy disorder. That's what it is. It's not about sex.
And that's a lot of your work at the Center for Relational Healing is intimacy disorders.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is addiction a physical and mental disorder, and is it genetic?
Addiction can definitely be genetic. I mean, you see it intergenerationally within families. So you will often see in my office, for instance, people that come in and there is a history of addiction. There is definitely a lot of research that does show, like from a genetic standpoint, it can be inherited. But also that can be, you know, you grow up with a parent who has an addiction and they have maladaptive way of coping and you see that they don't know how to regulate and self-soothe. And as a child, you kind of pick up on those things.
Right.
And in terms of the attachment piece, when you are young and you're either enmeshed by a parent and smothered or you're abandoned and neglected, that's going to impact how you can attach as you get older. And it can often make somebody love addicted. It can make someone love avoidant. It can make someone sex addicted. I mean, there's so many things that can happen. It is, I would say, a physiological and an emotional disorder for sure, because most people that have an actual addiction, even though we talked earlier about that withdrawal, they are withdrawing when they're not getting it. And they're, for them, it might be incredible anxiety, panic attacks, depression. So that's the physiological piece that I'm referring to. People get headaches and digestive issues, and my clients are in tremendous distress, and it's both physiological as well as emotional.
Can somebody be addicted to love, Marnie?
Yeah, they call it love addiction, but really it's more being addicted to a person. and to the attention and to the adoration and to the validation. And really, when somebody doesn't have a sense of self themselves, like they can't really esteem themselves, then they're looking to others to esteem them. So when they're getting lots of attention from somebody and they feel really great and desirable, like they're on cloud nine and they're happy. And then if they lose that, or the person that they're interested in is not returning that interest, or they're rejecting them, they could feel, this is a person that literally can become so depressed that they become suicidal. Like we see a lot of love addiction in inpatient and intensive outpatient settings.
When is sex addiction different than just cheating in a marriage?
The reality is that one of the reasons that I think sex addiction loses some credibility is that oftentimes when somebody gets caught cheating or engaging in some kind of egregious behavior sexually, sex addiction gets blamed, or it's often thrown out as the reason behind it. And the truth is that just because someone cheats does not make them a sex addict by any means. In fact, two different people can be engaging in the same sexual behaviors and even look like they're both addicts. And one is not an addict at all, meaning that they are making a conscious choice to do it. They're not feeling guilt and shame after the behavior. They're not saying, I'm never going to do this again. They're not acting against their own value system. Whereas an addict truly is not, they might love their partner. They might believe in every bit of their core that cheating and betraying the person they love the most is actually totally wrong and horrible and, you know, crushing. And they can't stop the behavior. They need to get that hit, just like a drug addict needs to get that hit.
But for most people, infidelity, or people come into one of your programs, which I love that you have actually recovery programs for people who are going through trauma or through cheating, through infidelity. Would you say that a lot of people in infidelity are sex addicts? It just seems like from what I hear mostly, it's more like they wanted love, attention from someone else. It wasn't so much of a sex addiction.
I do think that the reality is that people make conscious choices to cheat when they feel like they're not getting their needs met in a relationship. When they feel, when kids come into the picture and a mother, a parent, like a partner is not so, you know, so much available to their husband anymore to be there all the time, that often actually engages somebody in distancing themselves and starting affairs, getting it elsewhere. But that's not an addiction.
Right.
It's a choice, and it's a terrible choice. And we see a lot of disconnect in our society and today. And instead of couples coming together when things are tough or when they're struggling, they're moving further and further apart, and people make that choice.
What kind of help can people get if they're seeing some signs of sex addiction in the relationship?
There are so many treatment centers available now and places that specialize in betrayal trauma and sex addiction and infidelity. My center here in Los Angeles, the Center for Relational Healing.
For Relational Healing, Marnie's in LA. It's amazing. You should go there. Check it out. If you've had trauma, not just to hang out and say hi, although she's lovely.
Well, thank you. I will say that I have a phenomenal staff, and I take such incredible pride in the work that we do, but we're not the only people, obviously, that do this work. There are certified sex addiction therapists around the country as well as abroad, and there are partner specialists. I'm actually a certified clinical partner specialist as well, and there's an organization that trains therapists to be able to work with the cheated or betrayed partner. It's actually pretty easy to find help if you get online and you do a Google search, and then the type of treatment you get really depends on the acuity of what's involved. Like, if you've got a full-blown sex addiction case, sometimes, you know, outpatient therapy once a week is not going to be enough. Group therapy is important. 12-step programs, sometimes intensive outpatient therapy. It just really depends on what you're looking at.
Okay. Well, I'm curious about the programs that you have, because you have like groups for couples who are dealing with, like, you have intimacy coaching and healing workshops for couples specifically dealing with infidelity, which I just find, I didn't really know that that existed. And I feel like the reason why I thought this would be so relevant is I get so many, I mean, for everybody knows somebody who's cheated, they've been cheated on. And we hear from people all the time who say, well, it's been a year and I forgave him, or I let it go. And you can't rebuild trust on your own. You always need to get help for that, because it's just not going to come back. Can you define the difference between being a sex addict and a sex pervert? And they probably mean sex offender, I'm thinking, or
that's
sexual deviant?
I guess it would depend on how we're defining pervert, because, you know, somebody who is, for instance, a voyeur, who is looking at people, like peeping inside people's windows, things like that, or someone who's engaging in frauderism, which is touching another person without their permission. You see that like in crowded rooms or like on the subway where someone's rubbing up against you, and it can sort of be under the guise of, oh, it's just crowded in here, but it's an intentional conscious thing to do. That's perverted, and that definitely would fall into the under the category of sex offending. You know, sex addiction, you know, there could be people that have fetishes that are sex addicts, but I certainly wouldn't pathologize that and say that anybody's, you know, fetish is necessarily perverted. So I do think that they're pretty drastically different things.
Thank you, Marnie. This is amazing. So now we're going to go into some emails. Hi, Emily. I think I'm a sex addict, but I can't afford a therapist. And I don't want my wife to know about this. Are there bibliotherapy resources or other resources I can access to treat my sex addiction? What steps can I begin to take on my own? Thank you, Lee, 48, Toronto.
Lee, I'm so glad that you reached out, and there are resources. If you don't have the financial means to go and see a specialist, my first suggestion would be get to a 12-step meeting immediately. Mm-hmm. SAA, go online to SAA or SA.org. They are all over. There's phone meetings and computer meetings and lots of meetings in person, and you will connect with a lot of other people in a confidential environment and get a tremendous amount of support, work the steps. There's also tons of books out there that you can read. I will say that while I understand not wanting to tell your wife, at some point, it is the secrecy that's going to keep you from being able to connect to your wife and from really healing. So eventually I would consider letting her in and sharing with her.
Thank you. That is a great point. And did you say SLAA, like Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous?
SLAA is another one.
Okay, so you were saying SAA.
Yes.
Okay. So I think that that's just the key here. We think that these secrets, you know, like they say in 12, you're just as sick as your secrets, mm-hmm. that the more we reveal to others, we think that that's going to be the most devastating thing, but that's actually what heals us. Mm-hmm. So all these secrets and things that we can't deal with, especially with addiction.
Yeah. We see a lot of people recovering finally after doing the disclosure that weren't able to before they did a disclosure because they finally actually come clean and said everything that they were so terrified of saying and they held on for years. And then suddenly they're no longer walking around in shame.
Right. Exactly. Know? That's like the antidote to shame, right?
Right. It's kind of right. They're looking at their partner saying, you know everything that I've done. You've known every awful thing now that I have done and you still love me and you're here.
Right.
Like, oh, okay, you know?
Right, because we all kind of, a lot of us have a base, many of us have a fear of abandonment. And then if we have to pile onto an addiction that we're so ashamed of, like, right. It's just like this quagmire. But if you do reveal everything to your partner and they're still there, it's like, wow,
yeah,
you love
maybe
me.
I'm not
you
so
love
bad.
Me. Right. I don't have any more secrets. It's amazing. All right, more sex with Emily after this break. And thank you, everybody, for supporting our sponsors who help keep this show free. Okay, I'm talking to Erica Lust, and Erica Lust is an extraordinary woman who started changing the way we all see porn. She's making female-friendly porn. But that doesn't even work. I feel like that does a disservice because I want everybody to watch her porn. Mm-hmm. So ethically consumed, ethically created.
Yeah, all is okay. But then also, I've been through so many different kind of words or sayings that I've been trying to use during years. You know, I also kind of started out saying porn for women because I felt that we were, as women, were left outside the mainstream porn. So I kind of started that way. And then I got more into the say of feminist porn because it felt like, no, but I'm a feminist and it's really about, you know, women behind the camera and how we, you know, participate in this and how we represent women. And then it got more and more popular to talk about alt porn, alternative porn, indie porn, vanguard porn, artistic porn, ethical porn that it's starting right. to become. But I think all of these, they are really expressions of, you know, people's needs to find a new way of defining porn, because we have been so used to the tubes online. And nowadays it's like, that's what we really think about as porn.
Right.
But there's 100,000 types of different porn that's out there. And I guess the best way of collect them all would be under like some kind of indie adult porn label.
Right,
you know?
Indie adult, ethical. I just feel like when you start putting things like female or ethical, people are like, I don't want to watch like porn. Like, that right. don't need like ethical.
And with the feminist porn, the funny thing is that when you say that to people, they go like, what is that? That's like a bunch of women with a lot of hair under their arms and they put on the strap-ons, you know, and they're like this army ready to fuck the men. And you go like, no, that's not at all feminist porn.
All I can tell you is that it is super sexy. A hot porn that if I could have thought of the kind of porn I wanted to see before I saw your porn, it is the exact porn that I would make, that I would want to watch. And I even sent one to this guy that I guess I come up so there's a hard time. He's my boyfriend. I'm really not great. So, and he was like, yes, I love eroticized porn. I'd be so into watching this with you because I just got your site, right. which is amazing. So let's back up and talk about why your porn is different. It's cinematic. It's so just beautifully shot. There's stories, but it's real. And the women are portrayed as very authentic.
As human beings.
As humans.
Not as, you know, blow-up dolls. And the men are not portrayed as this kind of penetrative sex machines going on, aggressive, there to punish, fuck, and destroy all women on this planet.
Right.
That is one of the things that I feel many times with mainstream porn, especially when I, you know, sometimes go to the tube sites and I start, you know, navigating around and I get pissed off when I see the kind of language that they are using. It's so sexist, so racist, many times even homophobic. It's like dividing people into these fetishized little groups. And
so what do we do? Is it kind of like if you can't fight porn, then make good porn? Like, I feel like that's what you're doing. And part of me is like, I really am watching your stuff and thinking about it. Like, I think I want to leave and go off and make one of your films because I want to direct something.
Yes.
Just like everybody needs to in a way, because what you're saying is we're trying to fight this huge machine, I guess, of who are the men that are making all this porn?
It's a very good question.
Yeah.
It's a very good question. And I think it's an interesting point of view, because most of these men, because obviously it's an industry driven by men.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, people, they say, no, the porn industry is a very feminist industry because women earn more money than men, because they think about like five names of very famous porn stars that earns a lot of money. But then be realistic, who earns the money in this business? I mean, it's the company. It's the producers, it's the distributors, really. And if you think about the people making porn, then you realize that they are quite similar, even if they live in Budapest or Barcelona or Los Angeles or Buenos Aires or whatever. But it's the same kind of man, you know, a man that's interested in boobs and ass and his drinks and his cars and getting into the VIP room with a big bottle of, you know, that's the kind of man who is making porn. There are very few creative minds out there, very few, let's say, film directors, artists, people with visions and ideas.
So my question is it like the tail is wagging the dog or the dog wagging the tail, in the sense of if more people were able to see the porn that you made and that was the porn that was out there, do you think that would change the way men and women like learned about sex? Because we know that that's how people are unfortunately learning about sex right now.
I hope so. I hope it would change their mind. Not that I hope that they would learn from what is out there. But
do you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm wondering if that's why, like, all I know in the 13 years I've been doing this, like, no one ever asked me about anal before or squirting or men, like, just the things that came up that I know is directly related to porn, and we know that's how they're learning.
Because it is very influential as a genre. Porn is becoming very influential. They are talking about a so high number as a third of all the internet traffic during, you know, some hours of the day. Not always, maybe of the night, but depends on where you live, you know. But a third part of all the internet traffic, that's huge numbers. And obviously, I mean, I know that you are into sex education. I think sex education is the best answer we have at this moment. We need to start sex educating the masses, all people out there.
I agree.
Schools need to take in great sex educators and to help them explain the world to people growing up, because sex matters to them. Sex is one of the things that matters most to them.
Exactly.
You know?
You grew up in Sweden.
Yes.
So you had like the sex education that's hailed around the world as the best sex education, right? So you learned, it wasn't just like one class for an hour. It was like an ongoing discussion.
Ongoing conversation since I was a little kid until, you know, a grown up adult. Totally. We talk about sex as something quite natural. First, it starts with, you know, the body, learning about our bodies, different body parts, how they serve us and how we get pleasure out of them. You know, I talk a lot of times to people about the learning curve when it comes to sex. You know, little boys are starting to touch themselves and little girls are starting to touch themselves. And what happens so many times is when boys does it, people kind of laugh and it's like, cute, look, he's touching his little dicky.
Right.
And it's like kind of, that's normal because he's a little boy, right? So he's trying out his masculinity. But when girls does it, they get this kind of, don't do that. And many times from the people most close to them, their mothers, you know?
And that's their first message they get about their vagina is, no, it's private.
Totally.
Don't do it. It's dirty.
No,
it's wrong.
No.
And no one tells them, okay, now's the time to go have pleasure. They were just shut down at 4 or 5 when they were masturbating in the kitchen and told to go to their room. So that's right.
Exactly. And imagine how it would change if their mothers would tell them, you know, I know that that feels great, but maybe you should do it in your room instead of in the kitchen or in the living room.
Exactly. You know? But encourage, not shut them down.
Exactly.
And no one ever lifts them back up again.
Totally.
And then the next thing they see is porn. And then they're having sex with some guy making some weird noises that wasn't even coming from them or originating because they thought that's how they had to act.
Exactly. But also that poor guy growing up, you know, nobody talks to him about sex and he has a huge sex drive. And then he's been watching hundreds of hours of porn online. And suddenly he has an opportunity with a girl and he's getting in there. And he thinks that he has to behave as a porn star.
Right.
Because
literally,
that's what he's seen. So he goes for choking her. And she, you know, gets crazy and screams and say like, hey, what are you doing?
Right, why are you choking it? Right.
Totally miscommunication. And much of that is not, I wouldn't say that it's because of porn, but I would say it's because nobody tells them that the porn they are watching is an exaggerated fiction of sex, but it's not the same thing as having sex, right? Sex takes a lot of time. It takes time to get to know your own body, another person's body, how you connect together. That's hours and hours of work and trying and, you know, figuring it out. And porn is like, bam, 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 4 minutes. And then she screams. And it was only like penetrative vaginal sex. And that is nothing like real life. And most women I know, they need some clitoral stimulation to come, right?
Exactly. And we're not getting that at all.
Nope.
And I think it's a disservice because it's perpetuating what more and more men having sex growing up thinking like, they don't understand the clitoral stimulation. So let's talk about the porn that you're making, though. It focuses more on the emotional connection with sex, not so much as much. I mean, of course, it's physical, but how do you even explain it? Like, it's just like, that's what I want. I want you to, I guess it's the plot, but it's a story.
I mean,
but it's also, it's romantic. We're kissing for a while. Like, you're touching my face. I'm like, what? And then you could get into whatever.
Yeah,
but we want that.
But it's kind of, I used to say that it's all of it. I mean, the difference is really, if you compare it to mainstream porn, then it would be like comparing a fast food restaurant to a little family restaurant, you know. The whole treatment is different. It's different, you know, when I go to the market and I buy my ingredients and I think about what do I want to make and how do I want to set up the table and, you know, all of those small details. And that's how I work. It's not only me. I work with a kind of big crew. We are around 15 people behind the camera.
15 or 15?
15.
Yeah.
Most of us women, because it's something that I'm really pushing for.
Yeah.
I think we need to have more women behind the camera, more women on set.
What could we do? I'm just trying to think if there's some kind of educational porn for younger girls.
Yes, but it's always difficult because obviously I am not allowed to promote porn for people under 18. And I don't know, maybe here in America it's even 21.
Right, probably.
You know, and there we have this problem again that you can drive a car when you're like 16 and you can go to the army when you're 18.
Right.
And you can drink alcohol here, I think,
at 21.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But in Europe you can do it at 18.
Yeah, I know. It's much more liberal views towards sex.
Yeah.
So my question also is, we have women behind the cameras. What about the female talent that you work with?
Mm-hmm.
How would you say that that is different?
It's different for women and it's different for men also, because we are
all
humans.
For men and for women, how is it different?
And I do work with people who work also in the mainstream porn industry. And I guess what is very different is the whole process, because when I make a movie, it's more like any indie movie, you know, it's the same kind of ambient and the same kind of set. And then what I hear a lot from my female stars is that they feel very secure at my set because they are surrounded by so many other women, you know, because that is something that they feel a lot in the mainstream porn industry. It's managed by men. So most of the time they go to a set and there's only men around them. If they're lucky, there's a makeup artist, you know?
Right.
It's like, so
true.
In my set, they have this kind of sisterhood sisterhood feeling going on, they know that me and my crew, that we will look after them, yeah. that we, you know, will see if something is not right and then we will act on it. And that, I think, is very comfortable and yes. feels great. But it's all about really the ethical production process, and that should be a standard, whether we are talking, you know, feminist porn, indie porn, or mainstream porn. It should be a standard in any business out there, even if you're making buildings or, you know,
doing ethical
food
person, or whatever, ethical
you should be
ethics.
An ethical person with ethical values. And when it comes to filmmaking and porn business, I mean, what are ethical values? Well, it's informing your actors before shooting what will happen. So they are getting the script sent weeks before the shooting. They can give me feedback on that. I ask them with whom would they like to perform, to make sure that they are together with a partner that they trust and that they are attracted
right.
to, because that's like the whole difference when there's good chemistry between people. And most people who work in the porn industry, they have favorite co-workers,
right.
people that they really like to work together with. Then we talk about all the details. We do the STI testing, obviously, before the shooting. Actors always have the right to look at the other person's paperwork right. so they know that everybody is in the best conditions. We talk about condom use. Is that something they want to use
right.
or not? We talk about lubricants.
Right.
Are they allergic to anything?
What lubes do you want on set, right?
Exactly.
I love it. No, it
if
matters.
If toys are involved, then we talk about their boundaries and their limits. Is there something that they don't want to do? Something that they don't like, you know? Is there something they like particularly?
This is what every couple should do, by the way, before
yes.
they get together.
I mean,
or at least on the first or second date.
It's an obvious
like the
discussion.
Same thing? I know, it's so
and
obvious.
And it should be easy to have this kind of conversations with people about sex, because that is when sex works, when you can trust that everything has been taken care of. And then, of course, I always tell my performers that if they feel uncomfortable during a shooting, they can always cut.
Right.
You know, they can always tell me, I need a break, I need to go to the bathroom, I need water, I need
of
a
course,
towel.
Yes.
You know, this standard kind of things. And they know that I will never push their boundaries. I will never say to them, what do you think about now if we could do a little more? Maybe if we have agreed on doing vaginal sex, I would never ask them to do anal sex,
right,
for
right.
example. That is a totally no go, you know. I would never tell them there's a third person that I'm thinking would be interested if they
right,
would
you're
enter.
You're already turned on, so why, yeah,
exactly.
I get that.
But this kind of things, they do happen sometimes.
I
mean, the actresses and the performers, they are telling me about this kind of stories. I also have a lot of male performers telling me that sometimes they are in trouble because they are having trouble to maintain their erections.
So what do you do with that? Yeah.
Well, what I do is that I give them time, you know, I give them time and security, so hopefully that won't happen. But sometimes when there are, you know, regular shootings, they get very pressured, and then many of them take the kind of Viagra drugs
right.
they need to make it
right.
happen. And if they can't do it, sometimes I heard stories about producers who won't pay them, who say, like, if you can't do it, then, you know, I'm not gonna. And
would
that,
you ever
that
show
is
that?
Non-ethical behavior.
Right, I get
that.
To
be clear.
But you're realistic porn too. So what if the guy loses his erection? Would you keep that in the film where she gets him hard again?
I could. Yes.
Oh, wait, let's stop and make a sandwich where you get hard again.
I could definitely do that because I don't see it really as a problem.
It's real.
It could happen. It depends always on the film that you are doing and what you want to, you know, communicate. I mean, I did shoot, for example, a threesome where one guy had trouble for a while and he went away to the bathroom, the other two were going on, and then after a while he was good again, and then he came back
awesome.
In, you know,
but like there you are, it was
yeah.
flowed
it
like
was
a real threesome
exactly.
Someone's got to get up and go to the bathroom at some point.
Exactly. I'm all happy. I'm super happy to be here. It's been a wonderful conversation, really.
Oh, this was a fun show, you guys. I so enjoyed the show. I'm all riled up. We should go home and watch some more porn. All right, I gotta go. But don't worry, I'll be back soon with more Sex with Emily. You guys, there's so much more to talk about, so don't miss my next episode. Subscribe to Sex with Emily right now. Please like, review, and share this podcast with the ones you love. Was it good for you? email me, feedback@sexwithemily.com. Find us on all social media. It is @sexwithemily.